Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Poore. Recently, I had a discussion with Steve Greenfield about the divide in our country, and it was a very short clip that went on Pacifica Radio all over the country. So now we're going to expand on that particular issue, and Steve is going to talk about why he thinks there is a divide in our country. Steve, there's been a lot said and written about since the election. What's your impression of what's going on?
Well, we saw some things once again for the second consecutive election that defied all measurement of it going in, things that were that we were told were things that were known and measured going in turned out to have been completely false and completely the opposite of what actually materialized. And we saw it at many, many different levels. We saw also, of office, not just the election for the presidency, but in Congress and in state legislatures, throughout the entire spectrum of the elections, where, in fact, the presidential election aside, Republicans made significant gains. You know, there actually was a modest-sized red wave as opposed to the blue wave that everyone had predicted. In the presidential race, we saw Trump, who supposedly had a 35% approval rating going in, as well as the general history of this country in which presidents who are sitting atop substantial economic downturns and other administrative dysfunction, even over things that aren't necessarily their own fault, going back to Herbert Hoover, right? It obviously wasn't his fault that Wall Street collapsed, but the electorate made him pay the price. In light of all that, we saw that the voting support for Donald Trump went up by about 14% from 2016. He got 9 million more votes. It's fine to acknowledge that Joe Biden got even more than that, right, from what Hillary had gotten. And so, therefore, he's the winner, right? Okay, that is true on the face of it, but we're not looking at set decoration or window dressing. We're looking at an actual election. And the idea that somebody who had only a 35% approval rating in the midst of a health crisis and an economic crisis was able to see a surge, a 14% surge in his voting support that nobody saw coming, and obviously delivered substantial coattails to down-ticket races all over the country, whereas Biden, while winning the presidency, obviously delivered no coattails in any races. Democrats suffered losses throughout. Here, just in my own district, and to let the audience know again, I ran for Congress this year, as I did in 2018, on a minor party line as a Green against a Democrat incumbent versus an unknown Republican, the opposite of what I was doing in 2018, where I was running against a well-known and long-established Republican incumbent and an unknown Democrat challenging them. So the two scenarios basically flipped from the last election to this. And in this election, the Republicans basically had chosen to abandon the district. They had no named candidate, no previous office holder was willing to enter the primaries, and they only gave their primary winner $54,000 to run for this race, whereas they had given the previous candidate $15 million. John Faso, the previous Republican who ran, was given a total of $15 million to run on. So about half of that his own fundraising and the other half from the Republican National Committee and their Congressional Campaign Committee to be a $15 million budget. This time around, they gave their candidate $54,000. He had less than 1/100th of the money that the Democrat who won last time came in to run with. And yet, they're still counting votes. Okay, this is a district that is about 5,000 by enrollment favoring Democrats, The Democrat has also the power of the incumbency, and he had about a 110-to-1 funding advantage, and they're still counting the votes. He's going to win, but he's going to win by only about 3%, having spent $5.6 million versus the $54,000 that the Republicans spent. And so basically everything that experts thought they knew that they could measure and would be consistent, with only minor degrees of, error of margin variability within them, have once again been completely blown up. You know, they were blown up in 2016. And some of us have been telling people the entire time, you have to change your measurement models because everything was blown up. And all of the geniuses were saying, no, they weren't really blown up. It was just a one-time aberration, and we can use those again. But obviously, the results of this election show that they're blown up much more thoroughly and completely than they were blown up in 2016. And I really hope that we drop everything we think we know about elections, that enrollment differences are going to be the deciding factor, that how much money is spent is going to be the deciding factor. All of the standard measurements that polls about approval rating, that even polls about how people who consider themselves likely voters are going to be voting. Who knows if people are lying, if people aren't responding, whatever the reasons are, if someone who is got only $54,000 and a substantial voter enrollment disparity working against him could come within, 2-3% of the votes of an incumbent that spent $5.6 million, then obviously we need to start talking about a different dynamic in the American electorate than the one that we've been operating on, since, say, the Woodrow Wilson administration, or roughly that we've been operating on this same accepted knowledge base about how to measure and forecast elections. And what we've got, what we have to face up to, is that we've got people who are so polarized into two enemy camps that we have to assume from here on out that is going to be the guiding force. And we have to look at two things when we look at these two enemy camps who really don't care about anything in the policy arena. All they care about is opposing each other and defeating each other. And then what actually happens in legislation, or can be expected to happen in future legislation, in relation to the problems that the country is having at any given moment, has completely lost relevance. It's two hostile camps trying to defeat each other in the elections, and with no regard for what that means. You and I have discussed in the past that I believe we are in a post-solution America today, right? And the election result we just saw only confirms that yet again. Nobody is, but very few people are voting on the basis of what they think is the party or the candidate that's presenting a better set of solutions, like the classic, rational voter model. Almost nobody is voting on that basis anymore. We are voting on the basis of, we even use the word openly, electability. Who do we think can beat the other party? Who cares what their platform says? Right? That's what everyone talks about for the last 4, 5, 6 years. Electability, both sides. Nobody cares what any candidate's actually going to do or what any majority of either party might actually do if they win office, because we only care about defeating the other camp. Now, I will, right, put this in context. This country, we have to remember, we can't hold any illusions about this or play the, where the heck did that come from? Was it Fox's fault? Was it MSNBC's fault? Was it, this country was founded as two hostile camps, right? You had the pro-slavery faction from the South that was refusing to join the Union altogether unless the Northerners gave concessions in the political system that would prevent slavery from ever being voted out of existence. every step of the way through the Civil War, they kept adopting one more compromise after another to make sure that any new state, when new states were admitted to the Union, that we always admitted one slave state for every free state that was coming in. You know, the Dred Scott decision, they actually forced it to be government policy for people in free states to enforce the capture and return of slaves that had escaped from slave states. Like, suddenly nobody cared about states' rights. You know, when the Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed, nobody cared about states' rights. And then, of course, it all broke down. Those states ultimately seceded anyway in the fall and early winter of 1860 into 1861, and declared themselves to be their own country anyway. And then they were brought back into the Union by force at the expense of the lives of about 8 to 10% of the total American population at that time. From there, we continued that combat. You know, in the elections in the 1870s, Ulysses Grant, Rutherford Hayes, Grover Cleveland, all the elections were completely divided on whether there was going to be Reconstruction or whether we were going to end Reconstruction. And the Hayes election in particular was a contested election that was decided by Congress, and it was decided on the basis of the agreement by the Republicans at that time, the party of Reconstruction, to end Reconstruction. So in 1876, Reconstruction ended. The freed slaves never got their 40 acres and a mule. They never got the right to vote. They got, you know, the whole bit, right? And we continued along this way through the era into the 20th century, into the middle and late of the white citizens' councils being in control of Southern politics, and racist politics in general, that, you know, all that Fox News did and MSNBC did in the late 1990s was to make a choice to make money off, right? Which is what everybody's been doing all along, right? Everybody who had a way to make money off this division made money off the division. And so in 1996, Rupert Murdoch decided he would create a business that was built on the popularity of the Rush Limbaugh radio show, you know, which had developed such a huge audience by then, and create a network that would be entertaining to people of that sensibility. And that was immediately followed by an NBC forming a subsidiary called MSNBC that was going to try to capitalize on being entertaining to people who thought of themselves in the other encampment. And so that launched the age of, you know, competing media, competing sets of facts, you know, each one representing what validated the beliefs of their respective faction that was attracted to their business model, rather than being the kind of facts that we used to think we got from people like Walter Cronkite, you know, when you and I were younger. And so that's what brought us to where we are today. There has been a continuum. We were founded along this dividing line. And so that it's persisting to this day, and that we're back into a, you know, red-blue kind of version of the Mason-Dixon line, in which two vast encampments of people consider themselves to be internal enemies, to be domestic enemies to the United States. I don't know why anybody feels surprised about this. This is the entire history of this country going back to before we even achieved independence from Great Britain. So now I'll pause to take a breath. That's 13 straight minutes of me like setting up where we are, you know, and you can get a question in edgewise here, and then maybe we would talk a little bit about where we go.
Right. Let me ask you one question, though. You were talking about Fox and MSNBC, and you labeled it as entertainment. The people who watch those programs, do they watch it for an entertainment value, or to decide which platform they should concentrate on and vote?
Right. Well, that's the problem right there. No, they don't see it as entertainment. And the reason they don't see it as entertainment is because both of those networks have dressed up their sets to look like newsrooms. right? They have maps and graphics, and everybody sits at a desk, and they interview people. And so it is a very well crafted theater to create the appearance of journalism, and yet there's obviously no journalism going on at either location. Just as one example that stands out in my mind is an absolutely mind blowing, representation of how far from journalism both and into entertainment and infotainment that both of these networks go. During the primaries earlier in the year, MSNBC featured a what they referred to as a body English expert to try to guess whether Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren were being untruthful when they were arguing with each other over something that Bernie Sanders supposedly said about Elizabeth Warren's potential electability, or whether the public was prepared to elect a female president this year. And they brought on somebody they identified as a body English expert, who then said that because Bernie Sanders had his shoulders slightly hunched while he had his hands held up, that he was doing something that body English experts call turtling, which is proof that they're hiding, and that he was the one who was lying because his shoulders were hunched while he was talking. And that was someone who was being interviewed at a desk that looked like a news desk, with a map of the world behind it, and it looked very much like news. And people watching it, liberals who watched that show, actually thought they were watching, a journalist interviewing a scientist. Like, that's how far we have fallen. The business model of these infotainment, just like the original infotainment, right? Like A Current Affair and Access Hollywood and all those shows, like back in the late 70s and 80s, Entertainment Tonight, they make themselves look like a news show. People are wearing jackets and ties, and the women are wearing business suits, and they sit at desks, and it looks like news. But of course, it's not news. It's not remotely news. It is bias confirmation for people who want to believe that they're good people and good Americans and the people that know what's best and want what's best. And so they watch that, and then they've completely lost access to any evidence-based information that could allow them to actually be informed voters. They just get reinforced to them that we're these guys, and the other side gets reinforced to them, we're these guys, and each side explains why the other side is wrong and why your side is right and good and on the side of the angels. And then they go out to the field every November and do combat with each other.
Okay, let me ask you this. Donald Trump was known as an entertainer before he jumped into the political sphere, okay? So, you're talking about Fox and NBC. On Fox, there's Hannity. On MSNBC, there's Rachel Maddow. There's Chris Cuomo on CNN. Do these people consider themselves truly entertainers or news commentators?
That's a difficult question. They're hired to be news commentators, but they're hired to do so in a very limited perspective. They're not hired because of their capacity to think critically about any new piece of information that emerges on a given day, but to polish it the way that their intended audience would like to see it. So unfortunately, that's actually what most people today, students who finish college and go to journalism school, that's actually what they think they're supposed to be doing. They think that that's journalism. And so what actual journalism is has been lost through this entire process. There's no such thing as an independent thinker. You also, you know, you get canceled. If you're on Fox and you say something that the audience perceives as not aggressively anti-Democrat, you're going to be fired, because that audience is the people that buys the products that the advertisers sell. And if you're going to lose audience share, then the network's going to make less money, and the management is not being sensitive to the needs of the shareholders. So that person is going to get fired. Likewise, on MSNBC or CNN, if you are there and you break ranks on a particular issue, you know, you're going to lose your job for the exact same reason. If you were a pundit on CNN and you spoke like I do, if you said, how could anybody still be talking about employer-provided health care being functional and manageable when 40 million people just lost their jobs, and, you know, just when they most need health care, right? If you just declare that, or if you were to declare like I declare, you know, why is it when there's an accident on the highway and a joint response between the fire department and the ambulance squad are required, why is it that the fire department will cut you out of your upside down car and put you on a gurney and bring you to the ambulance and not give you a bill, but the second you get on the ambulance, now you're getting a bill? Like, why does that make sense? Now, see, if I went and spoke that way on CNN, the perception of the audience would be that I'm interfering with the election of Democrats and helping Republicans win by undermining the unity of liberals because these candidates happen to not support single-payer health insurance. And that instead of somebody saying, gee, what that guy said makes a lot of sense, you know, yeah, in the middle of a pandemic, how could anyone still be making this argument? This is the final proof that anyone ever needed that we have to separate healthcare from employment. And instead, the response of the mass audience would be, he's undercutting the electability of our candidates, and I would be fired. You know, I would be allowed on once in a while, maybe as like a, and here for an alternative, but I would never be allowed to be one of the regular on-air people, because the audience would rebel at the notion and not stop and contemplate, well, wait a second. But if more people in the media were supporting single payer, then maybe the candidates would have to support it as well, because they would get the message that people are going to vote on that basis and that they're receiving accurate information about the failings of employer-provided health insurance versus the success of publicly provided health insurance. And that just can't be allowed to happen, because that interferes with their business model. I would have to be fired. No. So, you know.
You know, you're talking about a schism in this country from its birth. How do people go past this? How can you make this a united country instead of a divided country when everything is set up against that?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to give you the answer that you would hope to hear, because I firmly believe that the answer is it can't be done. As I said, we've been divided since before the American Revolution, let alone the Constitutional Convention, and we're going to remain divided. We're not going to solve this. We don't have anybody who's interested. You can't win. What we care about, you know, you can't win office. What we care about as people now is not what are you going to do to solve the nation's problems. What we care about is what are you going to do to prevent the Republicans from getting elected? And the other side says, what are you going to be able to do to prevent the Democrats from getting elected? We're still in that pre-Civil War mindset. You know, what are we going to do to make sure that the new non-slave states won't eventually outnumber slave states? You know, that was the priority, right? To negotiate new compromises, the Missouri Compromise, the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Do not let Congress function unless they're going to admit as many slave states as they are free states. That was the priority. And we're still having that same priority today. How do you stop the other side from gaining a political advantage, a durable political advantage? Each side concerned more about that than they are about how do we solve the problems of this country? How do we deliver health care? How do we improve the economy? How do we raise wages? How do we protect the environment while still employing the bulk of our population? And still meeting energy demand, right? These are, you know, scientists would look at those things as problems to be solved, but politicians now only have the same one problem that we've always had since the founding of this country. How do we stop the other side from gaining more power over us than our side has? You know, that's all anybody's interested in. I'm telling you flat out, we're not going to solve it. We've never solved it. We've never gotten closer to solving it. I think there were two times in our history that we were close to solving it. One was in 1933 when Franklin Roosevelt started intervening in the Great Depression with public hiring, with minimum wage, with union protection, with Social Security for the elderly, and these things. A lot of problems got solved, and the public responded incredibly well by electing Franklin Roosevelt to four consecutive terms in office, right? Likewise, in 1964, a lot of solutions were created for American problems. We had the Medicaid for the poor. We had Medicare for the elderly. We had the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act. We were en route to then what became the Fair Housing Act, right? So for the first time since the Great Depression, powerful income increases, income protections, retirement security, health plans for the poor, incredible solutions to problems were being created. And they were being created bipartisanly. Remember, actually a higher proportion of Republicans voted for the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act than Democrats, because back then there were still a lot of Southern Democrats that were segregationists and not interested in any of this stuff. But the point being is that as a result of all that, the 1964 election elected 75% Democrats to both houses of Congress. And of course, Johnson as the president, this should have been the onset of a permanent solutions oriented America, right? 1932 to 1964 created a solutions oriented America. And then we backed away from it. And we decided that's not what we want. What we do now, I don't know. Yes.
We're out of time. So for anybody that wants to continue this conversation with us can do so on Twitter. So Steve, give your Twitter handle. I'll give mine. And maybe we'll get some people discussing this with us.
Oh, my Twitter handle, Greenfield4NY19, numbers and letters, right? It's Greenfield4Congress NY19. Greenfield4Congress NY19 is on Twitter.
And mine is All Exits Closed on Twitter. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Steve. Hopefully we can continue this discussion on the internet. Have a great day. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.